Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the programme.
When the news came on the radio that Monday morning in 1980, I was stunned. John Lennon had been shot dead outside his apartment building in New York. I was in digs at the time, making breakfast before heading for college. It was my first year in university. I was what was known as a mature student, in my case a euphemism for getting on track after a directionless start in life. I wanted desperately to share the news with someone, but there was no one about. Neither my landlord nor landlady were yet awake. I recall the feeling of shock and powerlessness that comes when you hear tragic news and you want to get to the scene of the tragedy, like you are some relative or close friend, just as I felt when the planes hit the World Trade Towers on 9/11. I went for a walk on the promenade in Salt Hill, looking out to the choppy sea and thinking of John Lennon and Yoko Ono's private island in Clew Bay, which Lennon bought in the late 60s. Ironically, Lennon had told the flocking media at the time that he wanted to get away from the blitz of attention in London. It's often recounted how Lennon came to my county of Mayo with his new girlfriend, Yoko Ono, in June 1968, having bought an island called Durinish the previous year. It ruffled a few feathers at the time. Some, older people usually, disapproved. Others, mostly younger, admired them for it. I remember a general response of bemusement and much witticism too at the idea of John and Yoko sitting back to back, naked and shivering on a lonely island under the great mountain of Crowpatrick. I was in my teens then, still at school and working Saturdays on a fruit lorry. Michael, the driver, and I journeyed from Castlebar to Achill Island via Mulrani, another place Lennon visited as he was getting interested in his Irish roots, to Westport and everywhere in between in the rattling old lorry, delivering to hotels and grocery shops. I loved the smell of ripe fruit and diesel, cutting along winding roads, above us sun, rainbows and fast-moving clouds. It was a liberating drive, getting to know my county intimately and the people we met and dealt with, as it had been earlier in my teens when I worked as a grocer boy, delivering to people in my town. I cycled a grocer bike in all kinds of weather, imagining myself as a good shepherd, bringing food to households, whilst Beatles songs jukeboxed in my head. On the fruit lorry journeys, we had dinner in a restaurant near the Octagon in Westport, and at the time of Lennon's visit, I listened as the disapproving restaurant owner said something about hippie types taking over the island out in the bay, and Michael, a kindly, soft-spoken man, nodded. They seemed to agree it was far better to leave the island to the sheep that were grazing on it than to let it play host to John and Yoko's reported orgies and drug-fueled parties. The bacon and cabbage was as delicious as the gossip. Like many of my generation, I lived through a songbook from a transistor radio in bed, trying to catch long-wave Radio Luxembourg, familiarising myself with the many genres in rock and pop music, and collecting the memorabilia of the first TV boy band, The Monkees. The music was refreshing and life-enhancing. The Beatles, with their blend of magic harmony and manic screams of fans, echoed across quiet towns and country lanes. Who wouldn't be excited? There was change in the air, and I loved it. I missed the chance to meet a musical hero that June 1968 as he stepped confidently along a street in Westport, dressed in an Afghan coat and followed by a flurry of cameras. We came a day later with our fruit deliveries, before finishing the day at the Octagon with a well-earned dinner of bacon and cabbage. John and Yoko had spent the first of only 2 days on the island. They never returned, though Lennon did give permission to a hippie commune to live on Durinish. They, too, eventually surrendered to the wild Atlantic elements and abandoned the island. But Durinish must have lingered in Lennon's mind as a place representing freedom or escape. In the early 1970s, he told Rolling Stone magazine his vision of life, when I'm 64, was him and Yoko as a nice old couple living off the coast of Ireland or something like that, looking at our scrapbook of madness. Years later, when I lived in Manhattan, I would pass the Dakota building where Mark Chapman shot John Lennon. I visited the Strawberry Fields Memorial in Central Park, never forgetting my Grocer Bike songs, the Fruit Lorry Journeys, Bacon and Cabbage Gossip, and the morning in December 1980 in my Galway digs when I had a great need to talk to someone.
Our life together is so precious. Together we have grown. We have grown. Although our love is still special, let's take a chance and fly away.
Anticipation builds as I cross over the railway bridge, walk along by the villa-style houses, glance at the cormorants like sentries on the rocks, before I arrive at the Martello Tower. Some of my friends are there already, in various stages of undress. A quick disrobing, swimsuit on, then down the slip, across the granite slabs. Excitement is mixed with trepidation. I clutch the rail and descend the steps. Oh, the water is cold as it slaps my calves. Then slow submersion into the Irish Sea. Surface again, gasp, steady my breathing before beginning a smooth stroke. I am in the moment. This is sublime. When I learned how to swim as a child on holidays in Kilkee, little did I think that sea swimming would prove a lifesaver during a pandemic. But it's not just the swimming itself, the adrenaline rush, the endorphin release. It's the tribe. The author Ruth Fitzmaurice, in her book I Found My Tribe, describes how she drew resilience and strength from sea swimming in Greystones when she was coping with her husband's motor neuron disease and raising five young children. More than the act of swimming, she says, was the group around her, jokingly called the Tragic Wives Club. While not all of us face what Ruth went through, the sea can be a salve for small irritants and big problems. My tribe, Snovaha Rin Namara, or Sea Point swimmers in Dunleary, has swapped one endorphin-increasing activity for another. During COVID-19, singing indoors is not allowed. So instead, members of our choir tread cold seawater and feel a rush of well-being similar to what we experience after a good singing workout. Because the smart little gremlins in my phone know that I like sea swimming, every day I receive another gem about its benefits. Apart from physical exercise, cold water swimming improves mental health, increases longevity, decreases loneliness, boosts your immune system. What else? Burns calories and increases libido. It's not unusual for people to look to the sea in times of trouble. A woman called June Curtin from Milltown Malbay in County Clare lost her husband to suicide in 2013. The years that followed were difficult for her and her two young children. When she was at her lowest, she says, she took to the sea and immersed herself. One small fact, which others might have seen as a deterrent, June couldn't swim. Undaunted, she continued her daily plunge at Spanish Point. Soon, one or two, four, six joined her. Today, there are over 300 swimmers in her Snovi Sosta tribe. And yes, June has learned to swim. This year's pandemic has hit people in different ways. Some of us have gone crazy. Maybe crazy in a good way. I've gone from being a strictly June to September swimmer to loving my winter dips and looking forward to a Christmas swim wherever that'll be. As I exit the water in Sea Point, the dressing routine begins. It's important to have the right gear so you don't get cold, They say the body keeps losing heat for about 20 minutes if you don't dry quickly and wrap up warm. There are even YouTube videos on how to get dressed, a skill I didn't know. An English woman, Rachel, on YouTube tells us, dry with robe or towel, easy peasy, trousers first, step into vest, sweater on, switch hats, booties off, furry slippers on, good to go. Absolutely no fumbling around. So, no knickers, no bra. Whatever you say, Rachel, I'm a newbie. Between the increased libido and the no underwear strategy, I'm in a bit of a whirlwind. At least I haven't signed up for skinny dipping. The coral swimmers are now dry and toasty warm at sea point, enjoying tea from flasks and brack from sandwich boxes. The conversation turns to cancelled carol concerts this year and how we could possibly raise money for the charities we usually support. What about a sponsored swim? Someone suggests. Maybe we could sell all the crafty knitting we've been doing during the pandemic, says another. Nothing is decided yet. But if you're passing Sea Point Martello Tower in the next while, don't be surprised if you see a socially distanced pop-up choir giving a cheery rendition of Jingle Bells, or even a bar or two of the Hallelujah Chorus.
I was in a shop recently in my home village and I crossed paths with a man with whom I spent several years in the big stick that was our national school. We talked about school days and about the terror of physical brutality and the fear of being asked a question by the Archbishop on Confirmation Day. Most of our memories seemed to revolve around dread. But then we moved on to the more important things in life and the man told me he was doing some work on the home place. "Hasn't been a haper done with it since the father died," he said. And then he went on to tell me about the work. I marvelled at the fact that he was doing it all himself. Insulating, replastering, replumbing, building an extension, redesigning the garden. "Ha, full duck or no dinner," he said. "But let me tell you, I was laying a new floor in the kitchen. Did the loveliest of jobs on it. But then, when I come to hanging the two doors again and I finish in it, and I find out that it wouldn't fit on account of the new floor being higher than the old one." He sighed as he told me about the time and effort that went into taking the doors down a second time, planing them and rehanging them. "But the main thing now is that the job is oxo," he said. And then, as though the strangeness of life had just struck him, he added, "And did we ever think, and we watching Jesse James below in the picture house, that we'd be wearing masks around the town and we grown men?" We shared a few further words and then he was gone. And I paid for the messages. Not the groceries, the messages I was collecting, and made my way to the car. As I unlocked the door, a voice at my shoulder made me jump. "I need to speak to you," the voice said. I turned and faced a woman about my own age. "Yes," I said. "I overheard your conversation with the fellow in the shop." "Right." "And I wondered if you could tell me, please, what a floor and a door are. I'm fascinated." "A floor is a floor," I said, "and a door is a door. You walk on one, you open and close the other."
"Oh, I see. A floor and a door. How charming. And one other thing. What in heaven's name is an oxo? Your friend said the job was an oxo."
"It's an expression," I said, "meaning everything worked out well. The job was fine."
"Oh, charming. Like some of the things we heard when we lived in Africa," the woman said. And off she went.
I sat into the car, took off my mask, and remembered those lines of Orwell in 1984. If thought corrupts language, language can also corrupt thought. And I wondered where I was and who I am. I drove through the streets of the village that once was home and remember the people I'd known as a child, the way they'd spoken, the fact that we were encouraged to adopt a different language, find a different accent, a way of speaking that would make us understood in the wider world, or so we were told. As I journeyed through school, there seemed to be an unspoken connection between accent, pronunciation and poverty. An assumption that the local accent would never be acceptable in the wider world. On my way back to where I now live, I crossed the county border that is as flat as our way of speaking. And I couldn't help but wonder what we lose in gaining the acceptance of a world that is no better, no wider, no more complex and no simpler than the one into which we are born and in which we live and try to grow.
The rain in Spain stays mainly in the plain.
The rain in Spain stays mainly in the plain.
Again.
The rain in Spain stays mainly in the plain.
I think she's got it. I think she's got it.
The rain in Spain stays mainly in the plain.
Walking out on stage, his guitar in hand, and wearing his trademark white peaked cap, there was no mistaking that this was Liam Clancy. To huge applause, he waved to the crowd. And even in the dimness of the unlit stage, you knew this would be a special night. Following behind him to an equally rousing cheer was his great friend Tommy Makem. Two silhouettes until the stage lights came on. And then it was as if the lights had switched on something in both of them. A hush descended over the packed auditorium and the clapping waned. There were introductions and laughter, and it wasn't long before stories were told, poetry was recited, and the banter between them began. Soon the music started to reverberate and rest in every nook, cranny and rafter of the theatre, to the delight of the audience. Liam would look upwards as he related a story or introduced a song, with a voice that was spellbinding. He would draw you in, paint a picture with his words, and he could tell a story better than any Shanachie. He was an actor, a raconteur, and an artist. But most of all, Liam Clancy was one of Ireland's greatest and most gifted folk singers who knew how to work a song expertly. He could sing songs of social issues, songs of the heart, laments and sea shanties, and songs of the ocean like no other. Born in Carrick-on-Shore, County Tipperary, on the 2nd of September 1935, he was Robert Clancy and Joanna McGrath's ninth and youngest child. While still in his teens, he explored writing and painting, but was particularly drawn to the theatre. Before he was 20, he had founded the local drama society. He met Diane Hamilton Guggenheim when she came over from the United States to his hometown to visit his mother in search of folk songs. She recorded Liam and invited him to accompany her on a tour of Ireland. During their 1955 trip, they went to Keady, County Armagh, to meet Sarah Makem, also a renowned folk song collector. And while there, he met her son Tommy for the first time. He began singing with his brothers at fundraising events, and the Clancy brothers and Tommy Makem began recording on Diane Hamilton's Tradition Records label in the late 1950s. They recorded the Rising of the Moon album in 1959 and toured all over America. Following their appearance on The Ed Sullivan Show on the 17th of March 1961, they became an international success. Their trademark Aran sweaters were sent over by Mrs. Clancy to her sons against the inclement weather, the sweaters inadvertently becoming an instant hit themselves. During the 1960s folk revival, the reputation and repertoire grew, and Lean became a close friend of Bob Dylan while they courted two sisters. Bob Dylan described him as the best ballad singer he had ever heard. In 1963, the Clancy brothers and Tommy Makem performed for President John F. Kennedy. And by 1964, 30% of all records sold in Ireland were the Clancy brothers and Tommy Makem. The repertoire included everything from The Leaving of Liverpool, The Shoals of Herring, Peggy Gordon, The Parting Glass, and so many more. They performed to sell-out concerts at Carnegie Hall and the Royal Albert Hall. When the Clancy brothers disbanded, Liam had a solo career in Canada and had a hit with The Dutchman. It happened that both Tommy Makem and he were in Cleveland, Ohio at the same time, and while there they got together and formed the duo, Makem and Clancy, to further huge success until 1988. Songs like Waltzing Matilda and The Garden Song are still continually requested. In later life, Liam lived in Ring, County Waterford, and Tommy in the United States. From their vast catalogue, a personal favourite is a song written by Stan Rogers. Stepping into the moment and in his magnificent theatrical voice, Liam tells the story of a ship called the Mary Ellen Carter, which sank off the coast of Nova Scotia in Canada. The captain had been drinking and the owners didn't particularly care, as they could claim the insurance. However, the crew had a deep connection with the ship and didn't want to leave her sleeping on the seabed, vowing that when springtime came, they would raise her to the surface and restore her to her former glory. While the song tells the story of the beloved ship, it's also a story of triumph over adversity. Though your heart may be broken and life about to end, no matter what you've lost, be it a home, a love, a friend, like the Mary Ellen Carter, rise again. Tommy Makem was also a gifted and successful musician in his own right. While very different personalities, together they were a match made in musical heaven. Tommy passed away in August 2007 at 74. Liam passed away on the 4th of December 2009 at 74 also. As the lights in the auditorium gently dim, and the clapping of the audience fades into the distance, the encore is over and the show has ended. The curtain has come down on a night when two friends and two musical legends were at their very best.
She went down last October in a pouring, driving rain. The skipper, he'd been drinking, and the mate, he felt no pain. Too close to Three Mile Rock when she was dealt her mortal blow, and the Mary Ellen Carter settled low. There was just us five aboard her.
The tanks rumbled down Ullui Avenue into Budapest. Dawn was breaking. November the 6th, 1956. Only 13 days before, the small nation of Hungary had successfully revolted against Russian oppression. In Irish terms, this was Hungary's 1916. Now, the tanks bearing the capital letters CCCP of the Soviet Union were on a mission to smash this Hungarian revolution. That same day, thousands of miles away, a plane carrying the members of the Hungarian men's national water polo team touched down at Darwin, Australia. Confused and anxious for news from home, they were nonetheless determined to do their best to represent their battle-torn home country in the 1956 Olympic Games in Melbourne. Weeks before, when the revolution started, they'd been in the hills above the city of Budapest, guarded by Russian miners with no access to a pool, radio, or telephone. In the city below, fires burned, gunshots could be heard, and the players didn't know if loved ones were dead or alive. They had trained hard for 4 years. Now the trip to Australia was in jeopardy. The uncertainty was excruciating, especially for the youngest player on the team. Erwin Zádor, at 21, was a rising star in the Hungarian team. From humble beginnings, thanks to an unbeatable spirit and an exceptional swimming talent, he had worked his way up in the game. His tenacity and endurance were lauded by his more experienced Olympian teammates. As a 6-year-old, Zádor once stood in the hall of the famous Olympic swimming pool on Margaret Island in Budapest. He looked up in awe at the names of past Hungarian champions etched into a marble wall and decided that one day his name would be up there too. So when word came the Hungarian Revolution had succeeded and the team could participate in the games, Zádor was elated. They boarded a plane for Australia, exhilarated over the new independence of their country. However, their fitness level was an issue for concern. They hadn't trained in a pool for weeks. Rumors reached them en route that tanks were pouring into Hungary to reimpose Soviet rule. Immediately upon landing in Australia, the one team member who could speak English grabbed a local newspaper to find out what was happening back home. The news wasn't good. The revolution had been crushed. One dream was now shattered. The dream of an Olympic gold medal still remained. From the start of the games, many spectators, aware of the suppressed revolution, cheered on the Hungarians. The boys delivered. The team adopted an innovative defensive strategy to compensate for the missed weeks of in-pool training. It worked. They remained undefeated up to the 6th of December 1956. On this day, the most infamous water polo match in Olympic history was to take place, the Melbourne Bloodbath. Water polo was never a game for the faint-hearted. Aggressive physicality and clever tactics make the sport gripping to watch. Kicks and punches occur regularly, especially underwater. In Hungary, huge respect persists for water polo, one of its most popular and successful sports. Exactly a month after the Russians crushed the Hungarian Revolution, the two teams that entered the pool that day were Hungary and the Soviet Union. The stage was set for a historic contest. 8,000 spectators crammed into a 6,000-seat stadium. The Russians were booed and whistled at on every touch of the ball. The crowd chanted, "Hajrá, Magyarok! Go, Hungary!" Apart from the atmosphere, the conditions for the two countries were fair and equal. The Hungarian players knew, by beating the Soviet Union, they would give a massive lift to all Hungarians. Erwin Zádor later recalled the strategy had been to provoke the Russians. "We play, they fight. Back home, we were obliged to learn 2 hours of Russian every day. So in their own language, we were able to tell them how much we disliked them. Soon they were fighting with us. The strategy worked. With 2 minutes to go in a ferocious game, the Hungarians were leading 4-0 when Zádor got punched by his Russian marker, Valentin Prokopov. The blow created a deep cut near Zádor's right eye, which welled up with blood. Instructed to leave the pool, the injured player left a trail of bloody water behind him. Many spectators rose from their seats, demanding the game be brought to an end and that the Hungarians be declared the winners. Others clambered furiously over barriers to have a go at the Russian players. The referee halted the match a minute early, and the police had to intervene and escort the Russian players to safety. The next day, the image of Zádor's bloody face made the front pages around the world. Because of his injury, Zádor could not participate in the final against Yugoslavia. The team won 2-1, and the Hungarian water polo team were awarded gold medals. About one-third of the Hungarian Olympic delegates did not return to Hungary behind the Iron Curtain. The defectors included half of the water polo gold medalists. Zádor made it to the United States, settling in Linden, California. He never played water polo again, but coached Mark Spitz, who went on to become one of the greatest Olympic swimmers of all time. Zádor didn't see Hungary again for over 40 years. In 2002, the surviving members of both teams had an emotional reunion in Budapest. The handshake that should have taken place in 1956 in Melbourne finally happened in Budapest. They agreed that the game symbolized something much greater than the sport. Players on both teams were victims of political circumstances. It was on this visit to Hungary that the Olympians were brought back to their training pool on Margaret Island. Once again, Zádor found himself standing in the hall where he stood as a six-year-old, looking up at the names of Hungarian champions etched into the marble wall. There, among the names of his 1956 teammates, he saw the two words, Zádor, Erwin.
The writing and the writers on this morning's Sunday Miscellany were John Lennon in Mayo by Aidan Hines, Winter Sea Swimming, which was by Nollaig Rowan, John McKenna with Our Way of Speaking, A Match Made in Heaven was by Mary Wall, and the last piece, Blood in the Water, was by Bernadette Buda. The music this morning, Just Like Starting Over by John Lennon. The Hallelujah Chorus from Handel's Messiah was sung by the Bratislava City Choir. The Rain in Spain from My Fair Lady, sung by Marnie Nixon with Rex Harrison and Wilfred Hyde White. And The Mary Ellen Carter, which was sung by Liam Clancy. Sunday Miscellany's broadcast coordinator is Carolyn Dempsey and the producer is Sarah Binchy.
RTE Radio 1.
You've been listening to the Sunday Miscellany podcast. For more from us, you can follow the programme on Facebook, Twitter, Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.